Chapter 7 of He Can Who Thinks He Can by Orison Swett Marden. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Responsibility develops power. There is enough latent force in a Maximite torpedo shell to tear a warship to pieces. But the amount of force or explosive power in one of these terrific engines of destruction could never be ascertained by any ordinary concussion. Children could play with it for years, pound it, roll it about, and do all sorts of things with it. The shell might be shot through the walls of an ordinary building without arousing its terrible dynamic energy. It must be fired from a cannon with terrific force, through a foot or so of steel plate armor, before it meets with resistance great enough to evoke its mighty explosive power. Every man is a stranger to his greatest strength, his mightiest power, until the test of a great responsibility, a critical emergency, or a supreme crisis in his life calls it out. Work on a farm, hauling wood, working in a tannery, storekeeping, West Point, the Mexican War, doing odd jobs about town, were not enough to arouse the sleeping giant in General Grant. There is no probability that he would ever have been heard of from outside his own little community but for the emergency of the Civil War. There was a tremendous dynamic force in the man, but it required the concussion of the great Civil War to ignite it. No ordinary occasion touched his slumbering power. No ordinary experience could ignite the powder in this giant. Under common circumstances, he would have gone through life a stranger to his own ability, just as most of the great dynamite shells now in existence will probably never be exploded because of the lack of a war emergency great enough to explode them. Farming, wood chopping, rail splitting, surveying, storekeeping, the state legislature, the practice of law, not even the United States Congress furnished occasions great enough, resistance strong enough, to ignite the spark of power, to explode the dynamic force in Abraham Lincoln. Only the responsibility of a nation in imminent peril furnished sufficient concussion to ignite the giant powder in perhaps the greatest man that ever trod the American continent. There is no probability that Lincoln would have gone down in history as a very great man but for the crisis of the Civil War. The nation's peril was the responsibility thrust upon him which brought out the last ounce of his reserves, his latent power of achievement, the resources which he never would have dreamed he possessed but for this emergency. Some of the greatest men in history never discovered themselves until they lost everything but their pluck and grit, or until some great misfortune overtook them and they were driven to desperation to invent a way out of their dilemma. Giants are made in the stern school of necessity. The strong, vigorous, forceful, stalwart men who have pushed civilization upward are the products of self-help. They have not been pushed or boosted, but they have fought every inch of the way up to their own loaf. They are giants because they have been great conquerors of difficulties, supreme masters of difficult situations. They have acquired the strength of the obstacles which they have overcome. Many of our giant businessmen never got a glimpse of their real power until some great panic or misfortune swept their property away and knocked the crutches out from under them. Many men and women never discovered their ability until everything they thought would help them to success had been taken away from them, until they had been stripped of everything that they held dear in life. Our greatest power, our highest possibility, lies so deep in our natures that it often takes a tremendous emergency, a powerful crisis, to call it out. It is only when we feel that all bridges behind us are burned, all retreat cut off, and that we have no outside aid to lean upon, that we discover our full inherent power. As long as we get outside help, we never know our own resources. How many young men and young women owe their success to some great misfortune, which cut off a competence, death of a relative, the loss of business or home, or some other great calamity, which threw them on their own resources and compelled them to fight for themselves. Responsibility is a great power developer. Where there is responsibility, there is growth. People who are never thrust into responsible positions never develop their real strength. This is one reason why it is so rare to find very strong men and women among those who have spent their lives in subordinate positions, in the service of others. They go through life comparative weaklings because their powers have never been tested or developed by having great responsibility thrust upon them. Their thinking has been done for them. They have simply carried out somebody else's program. They have never learned to stand alone, to think for themselves, to act independently. Because they have never been obliged to plan for themselves, they have never developed the best things in them. Their power of originality, inventiveness, initiative, independence, self-reliance, their possible grit and stamina. The power to create, to make combinations, to meet emergencies. The power which comes from continuous marshaling of one's forces to meet difficult situations, to adjust means to ends. That stamina or power which makes one equal to the great crisis in the life of a nation is only developed by years of practical training under great responsibility. There is nothing more misleading than the philosophy that if there is anything in a youth, it will come out. It may come out, and it may not. It depends largely upon circumstances, upon the presence or absence of an ambition-arousing, a grit-awakening environment. The greatest ability is not always accompanied by the greatest confidence or the greatest ambition. There is at this moment enough power latent in the clerks or ordinary employees in almost any of our business houses to manage them as well as, or better than they are being managed today, if the opportunity and necessary emergency to call out this dynamic force should arise. But how can clerks who remain behind counters, measuring cloth, selling shoes or hosiery, year in and year out, ever know what latent power for organization, what executive ability or initiative they possess? It is true that some of the more ambitious and courageous get out and start for themselves, but it does not follow that they are always abler than those who remain behind. Sometimes the greatest ability is accompanied by great modesty and even timidity. Then again, employees conscious of great ability are often deferred from taking the risk of launching out for themselves because of possible disaster to those depending upon them for daily bread. But thrust great responsibility upon a man, drive him to desperation, and the demand will bring out what there is in him. It will call out his initiative, his ingenuity, his resourcefulness, his self-reliance, his power to adjust means to ends. If there are any elements of leadership in him, responsibility will call them out. It will test his power to do things. I have in mind a young man who developed such amazing ability within 6 months from the date of a very important promotion that he surprised everybody who knew him. Even his best friends did not believe that it was in him. But the great responsibilities, the desperate situation thrust upon him brought out his reserve power, and he very quickly showed of what stuff he was made. This promotion and a little stock in the concern, which had been given him, aroused his ambition and called out a mighty power which before he did not dream he possessed. Tens of thousands of young men and young women today are only waiting for a chance to show themselves, waiting for an opportunity to try their wings. And when the opportunity, the responsibility comes, they will be equal to anything that confronts them. Proprietors of large concerns are often very much exercised by the death of a superintendent or lieutenant who is managed with exceptional ability. They are fearful that very disastrous results may follow and believe it will be almost impossible to fill his place. But while they are looking around to find a man big enough for the place, someone perhaps, who was under the former chief, attends to his duties temporarily, and makes even a better manager than his predecessor. Young men and young women are rising out of the ranks constantly, everywhere, who fill these positions oftentimes much better than those who drop out, and whose places it was thought almost impossible to fill. Do not be afraid to pile responsibility upon your employees. You will be amazed to see how quickly they will get out from under their load and what unexpected ability they will develop. Many employers are always looking for people outside of their own establishment to fill important vacancies, simply because they cannot see or appreciate a man's ability until he has actually demonstrated it. But how can he demonstrate it until he has the chance? There are probably today scores of young men in every one of our great business houses who are as capable as the present heads. There is no position that cannot be filled as well or better than it's being filled now by someone who is still in the ranks, and who has not yet been heard from in any distinctive way. When some great statesman falls, the people often look about, to find that there is apparently no one to fill his place, but from an unexpected source, perhaps from a little out-of-the-way town, from the common ranks, there comes a man who is equal to the emergency. The way to bring out the reserve in a man is to pile responsibility upon him. If there is anything in him, this will reveal it. Some of us never quite come to ourselves in fullness and power until driven to desperation. It is when we are shipwrecked, like Robinson Crusoe upon an island, with nothing but our own brain and hands, nothing but resources locked up deep in ourselves, that we really come to complete self-discovery. A captain never knows what is in his men until they have been tested by a gale at sea which threatens shipwreck. That there are great potencies and power possibilities within us which we may never know is proved by the tremendous forces that are aroused in ordinary people in some great crisis or emergency. The elevator boy may have never dreamed that there was anything heroic in his nature. He may never have thought there was a possibility of his rising in the world to the importance of the men whom he lifted to their offices. But the building takes fire, and this boy, who was seldom noticed by anyone, who did not show any special signs of ability, in a few minutes develops the most heroic qualities. He runs his elevator up through the burning floors when choked with smoke, the hot cable blistering his hands, and rescues 100 people, who but for him might have lost their lives. A ship is wrecked at sea, and a poor immigrant becomes the hero of the hour, commanding a lifeboat and giving orders with calmness, authority, and force, when others have lost their heads. A hospital takes fire, and the delicate, timid girl invalid develops into a heroine almost instantly and does a giant's work. In fires and wrecks, in great disasters or emergencies of all kinds, are enacted deeds of daring and of sublime heroism which, before the great test came, would have been thought impossible by those who did them. No one ever knows just how much dynamic force there is in him until tested by a great emergency or a supreme crisis. Oftentimes, men reach middle life and even later, before they discover themselves. Until some great emergency, loss, or sorrow has tested their timber, they cannot tell how much strain they can stand. No emergency great enough to call out their latent power ever before confronted them, and they did not themselves realize what they would be equal to until the great crisis confronted them. I have known several instances where daughters reared in luxury were suddenly thrown upon their own resources by the death of their parents and the loss of their inherited fortunes. They had not been brought up to work, did not know how to do anything useful, had no trade, and no idea how to earn a livelihood, and yet all at once they developed marvelous ability for doing things. The power was there, latent, but responsibility had not hitherto been thrust upon them. Young men suddenly forced into positions of tremendous responsibility by accident or death are often not the same men in 6 months. They have developed strong, manly qualities which no one ever dreamed they possessed. Responsibility has made men of them, and it makes women of inexperienced and untried girls who are suddenly thrust into an emergency where they are obliged to conduct a business or support a family. Many people distrust their initiative because they have not had an opportunity to exercise it. The monotonous routine of doing the same work year in and year out does not tend to develop new faculties. All the mental powers must be exercised, strengthened, before we can measure their possibilities. I know young men who believe in everybody but themselves. They seem to have no doubt about other people accomplishing what they undertake, but are always shaky about themselves. Oh, do not put me at the head of this or that. Somebody else can do it better than I. They shrink from responsibility because they lack self-faith. The only way to develop power is to resolve early in life never to let an opportunity for doing so go by. Never shrink from anything which will give you more discipline, better training, and enlarged experience. No matter how distasteful, force yourself into it. There is nothing like responsibility for developing ability. Never mind if the position is hard. Take it and make up your mind that you are going to fill it better than it was ever before filled. I once heard a man say he regretted more than anything else in his life that he had indulged his natural inclination to decline every position of responsibility offered him. He was naturally so shy that any position which attracted attention or gave him the least publicity was distasteful to him. His magnificent possibilities remain undeveloped because he has never had that responsibility which calls out one's reserves and develops his latent powers. Many a time he thought he would change his course and made up his mind never to let another opportunity for self-development go by him unimproved. But the habit of delaying until he should be better prepared got such a hold of him that he could not change. The result is that, although he is a man of recognized power, with a superb mind, his life has been an extremely quiet one, very tame and unimportant compared with what it would have been had he made it a rule to thrust himself into every position of responsibility, which would have called out the best in him. Many people never discover themselves or know their possibilities because they always shrink from responsibility. They lease themselves to somebody else and die with their greatest possibilities unreleased, undeveloped. Personally, I believe it is the duty of every young person to have an ambition to be independent, to be his own master, and to resolve that he will not be at somebody else's call all his life, come and go at the sounding of a gong or the touch of a bell, that he will at least belong to himself, that he will be an entire wheel and not a cog, that he will be a whole machine, although it may be a small one, rather than part of someone else's machine. The very stretching of the mind toward high ideals, the looking forward to the time when we shall be our own masters, working along the lines of a resolution, a fixed, irrevocable determination, has a strengthening, unifying influence upon all the faculties. And you will be a stronger man or woman, whatever your future, if you keep steadily, persistently in your mind your own individual declaration of independence. It means freedom. It means delivery from restraint, from a certain feeling of slavery which attaches to every subordinate position. I do not believe that it is possible for anyone to reach the same magnitude of manhood or womanhood to grow to the same stature after giving up the struggle for absolute independence or the hope of going into business or profession or something else all of one's own. It is true that not every person has the executive ability or strength of mind, the qualities of leadership, the moral stamina, or the push to conduct a business successfully for himself and stand his ground. There are also many instances of young men who have others dependent upon them, and who are not in a position to take the risks of going into business for themselves. A great many, however, work for others merely because they do not dare to take the risk of starting on their own responsibility. They lack the courage to branch out. The fear of possible failure deters them. Moreover, a great many start as boys in certain occupations, work up to a fairly good salary, and though they may be ambitious to be independent, are yet held back by the distrust of their own powers and the advice of others to let well enough alone until the habit of doing the same thing year in and year out becomes so fixed that it is very difficult to wrench themselves out of their environment. Again, a great many people prefer a small certainty to a big uncertainty. There is no disposition to hazard, no desire to take risks in their makeup. They do not want to assume large responsibilities. They prefer steady employment and the certainty that every Saturday night they will find fixed sums in their pay envelopes to the great risks, responsibilities, and uncertainties of a business of their own. You may not have the ambition, the desire, or the inclination to take responsibility. You may prefer to have an easier life and to let somebody else worry about the payment of notes and debts, the hard times, the dull seasons, and the panics. But if you expect to bring out the greatest possibilities in you, if growth, with the largest possible expansion of your powers, is your goal, you cannot realize your ambition in the fullest and completest sense while merely trying to carry out somebody else's program and letting him furnish the ideas. There must be a sense of complete independence, not partial but complete, in order to reach the highest growth. We do not attain our full stature of manhood or womanhood in captivity or in slavery, but in freedom, in absolute liberty. The eagle must be let out of the cage, no matter how large or how comfortable, before it can exhibit all the powers of an eagle. It is the locked-up forces within that lie deep in our natures, not those which are on the surface, that test our mettle. It is within everybody's power to call out these hidden forces, to be somebody, and to do something worthwhile in the world, and the man who does not do it is violating his sacred birthright. Every man or woman who goes through the world with great continents of undiscovered possibilities locked up within him commits a sin against himself, and that which borders on a crime against civilization. Don't be afraid to trust yourself. Have faith in your own ability to think along original lines. If there is anything in you, self-reliance will bring it out. Whatever you do, cultivate a spirit of manly independence in doing it. Let your work express yourself. Don't be a mere cog in a machine. Do your own thinking and carry out your own ideas as far as possible, even though working for another. End of chapter 7. Chapter 8 of He Can Who Thinks He Can by Orson Swett Marden. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. An overmastering purpose. Before water generates steam, it must register 212 degrees of heat. 200 degrees will not do it. 210 will not do it. The water must boil before it will generate enough steam to move an engine, to run a train. Lukewarm water will not run anything. A great many people are trying to move their life trains with lukewarm water, or water that's almost boiling, and they are wondering why they are stalled, why they cannot get ahead. They are trying to run a boiler with 200 or 210 degrees of heat, and they cannot understand why they do not get anywhere. Lukewarmness in his work stands in the same relation to a man's achievement as lukewarm water does to the locomotive boiler. No man can hope to accomplish anything great in this world until he throws his whole soul, flings the force of his whole life into it. In Philip Brooks's talks to young people, he used to urge them to be something with all their might. It is not enough simply to have a desire to be something. There is but one way to accomplish it, and that is to strive to be somebody with all the concentrated energy we can muster. Any kind of human being can wish for a thing, can desire it, but only strong, vigorous minds with great purposes can do things. There is an infinite distance between the wishers and the doers. A mere desire is lukewarm water, which never will take a train to its destination. The purpose must boil, must be made into live steam to do the work. Who would ever have heard of Theodore Roosevelt outside his immediate community if he had only half committed himself to what he had undertaken, if he had brought only a part of himself to his task? The great secret of his career has been that he has flung his whole life, not a part of it, with all the determination and energy and power he could muster, into everything he has undertaken. No dilly-dallying, no faint-hearted efforts, no lukewarm purpose for him. Every life of power must have a great master purpose which takes precedence of all other motives. A supreme principle which is so commanding and so imperative in its demands for recognition and exercise that there can be no mistaking its call. Without this, the water of energy will never reach the boiling point. The life train will not get anywhere. The man with a vigorous purpose is a positive, constructive, creative force. No one can be resourceful, inventive, original, or creative without powerful concentration, and the undivided focusing of the mind is only possible along the line of ambition, the life purpose. We cannot focus the mind upon a thing we are not interested in and enthusiastic about. A man ought to look upon his career as a great artist looks upon his masterpiece, as an outpicturing of his best self, upon which he dwells with infinite pride and a satisfaction which nothing else can give. Yet many people are so loosely connected with their vocation that they are easily separated from it. I know young men who seem anxious to get on in their careers, but in a single evening they could be induced to give up their calling for something else. They are always wondering whether they are in the right place or where their ability will count most. They lose heart when they strike obstacles, or they become discouraged when they hear of someone else who has made a success in some other line, and wonder if they had not better try something in the same line. If one is so loosely attached to his occupation that he can be easily induced to give it up, you may be sure that he is not in the right place. If nature has called you to a position, if the call runs in your blood, it is a part of your life and you cannot get away from it. It is not a separate thing from yourself. It exists in every brain cell, every nerve cell, every blood corpuscle contains some of it. You can no more get away from it than a leopard can get away from his spots. So when a young man asks me if I do not think he had better make a change, I feel very certain that he is not in the place God called him to, for the thing he was made for is as much a part of his real being as his temperament. It is nearer to him than his heartbeat, closer than his breath. There is a photograph of the thing he was made for in every cell in his body. He cannot get away from it. The thing which will make the life distinctive, which will make it a power, is the one supreme thing which we want to do, and feel that we must do, and no matter how long we may be delayed from this aim, or how far we may be swerved aside by mistakes or iron circumstances, we should never give up hope or a determination to pursue our object. Some people have not the moral courage, the persistence, the force of character, to get the things out of the way which stand between them and their ambition. They allow themselves to be pushed this way and that way into things for which they have no fitness or taste. Their willpower is not strong enough to enable them to fight their way to their goal. They are pushed aside by the pressure about them and do the things for which they have little or no liking or adaptation. If there's anything in the world a person should fight for, it is freedom to pursue his ideal, because in that is his great opportunity for self-expression, for the unfoldment of the greatest thing possible to him. It is his great chance to make his life tell in the largest, completest way, to do the most original, distinctive thing possible to him. If he does not pursue his ideal, does not carry out his supreme aim, his life will be more or less a failure, no matter how much he may be actuated by a sense of duty, or how much he may exert his willpower to overcome his handicap. There is great power in a resolution that has no reservation in it, a strong, persistent, tenacious purpose which burns all bridges behind it, clears all obstacles from its path, and arrives at its goal, no matter how long it may take, no matter what the sacrifice or the cost. The inspiration of a great, positive aim transforms the life and revolutionizes a shiftless, ambitionless, dissipated, good-for-nothing man, as if some divine energy had worked in him, even as love sometimes transforms a slovenly, purposeless, coarse man into a clean, methodical, diviner being. When the awakening power of a new purpose, a resolute aim, is born in a man, he is a new creature. He sees everything in a new light, the doubts, the fears, the apathy, the vicious temptations which dogged his steps but yesterday, the stagnation which had blighted his past life, all vanish as if by magic. They are dispelled by the breath of a new purpose. Beauty and system take the place of unsightliness and confusion. Order reigns in the place of anarchy. All his slumbering faculties awaken to activity. The effect of this new ambition is like the clarifying change made by a waterway in a stagnant, swampy district. The water clarifies as soon as it begins to move, to do something. Flowers spring up in place of poisonous weeds, and vegetation, beauty, birds and song make joyous the once miasmic atmosphere. Chemists tell us that when a compound is broken up and an atom is released from the attraction of other atoms, it takes on a new energy and immediately seeks combination with another free atom. But the longer it remains alone, the weaker it becomes. It seems to lose much of its vitality and power of attraction when idle. When the atom is first freed from the grasp of its fellows, it is called nascent, newborn. It is then that it has its maximum of gripping power, and if it finds a free atom immediately after it is released, it will unite with it with greater vigor than ever. The power seems to go out of it if it delays its union with another atom. Mythology tells us that Minerva, the goddess of wisdom, sprang complete, full-orbed, full-grown from Jupiter's brain. Man's highest conception, his most effective thought, most inventive and resourceful ideas, and grandest visions spring full-orbed, complete, with their maximum of power, spontaneously from the brain. Men who postpone their visions, who delay the execution of their ideas, who bottle up their thoughts to be used at a more convenient time, are always weaklings. The forceful, vigorous, effective men are those who execute their ideas while they are full of enthusiasm of inspiration. Our ideas, our visions, our resolutions come to us fresh every day, because this is the divine program for the day, not for tomorrow. Another inspiration, new ideas will come tomorrow. Today, we should carry out the inspiration of the day. A divine vision flashes across the artist's mind with lightning-like rapidity, but it is not convenient for him to seize his brush and fasten the immortal vision before it fades. He keeps turning it over and over in his mind. It takes possession of his very soul, but is not in his studio, or it is not convenient to put his divine vision upon canvas, and the picture gradually fades from his mind. A strong, vigorous conception flashes into the brain of the writer, and he has an almost irresistible impulse to seize his pen and transfer the beautiful images and the fascinating concept to paper. But it is not convenient at the moment, and while it seems almost impossible to wait, he postpones the writing. The images and the conception keep haunting him, but still he postpones. Finally, the visions grow dimmer and dimmer, and at last fade away and are lost forever. There is a reason for all this. Why do we have these strong, vigorous impulses, these divine visions of splendid possibilities? Why do they come to us with such rapidity and vigor, such vividness and suddenness? It is because it is intended that we shall use them while fresh, execute them while the inclination is hot. Our ideas, our visions are like manna of the wilderness, which the Israelites were obliged to gather fresh every day. If they undertook to hoard it, it became stale, the nourishment evaporated, the life went out of it. They could not use old manna. There is something about allowing a strong resolution to evaporate without executing it that has a deteriorating influence upon the character. It is the execution of a plan that makes stamina. Almost anybody can resolve to do a great thing. It is only the strong, determined character that puts the resolve into execution. If we could only make our highest moments permanent, what splendid things we should do in life, and what magnificent beings we should become. But let our resolutions cool, our visions fade, until it's more convenient to execute them, and they're gone. There is no easier way in which one can hypnotize or deceive himself than by thinking that because he is always making great resolutions, he is doing something worthwhile or carrying them out. I know a man who would feel insulted if anyone were to intimate that he had not been a hard worker and had not accomplished a great deal in life. And yet, although he is an able man, his whole life has been spent in jumping out of one thing into another so quickly that one could scarcely see the change. Yet every time you see him, he carries his head high. He is as enthusiastic and optimistic as though his whole life had been one triumphant march. His enthusiasm is intense, but it fades away just as quickly as it came. The very fact that he always lives in the clouds, is always dreaming of the great things he is going to do, seems to convince him that he actually does them. But he never stays at one thing long enough to reach effectiveness. His whole life has been spent in starting things brilliantly and enthusiastically. Few men have ever begun so many things as he, or completed so few. The putting off habit will kill the strongest initiative. Too much caution and lack of confidence are fatal enemies of initiative. How much easier it is to do a thing when the purpose impels us, when enthusiasm carries us along, than when everything drags in the postponement. One is drudgery, the other delight. Hungering and striving after knowledge is what makes a scholar. Hungering and striving after virtue is what makes a saint. Hungering and starving after noble action is what makes a hero a man. The great successes we see everywhere are but the realization of an intense longing, a concentrated effort. Everyone is gravitating toward his aim just in proportion to the power and intensity of his desire and his struggle to realize it. One merely desires to do this or that, or wishes he could, or would be glad if he could. Another knows perfectly well that if he lives, he's going to do the thing he sets his heart on, if it is within the limits of human possibility. We do not hear him whining because nobody will pay his way to college. He does not say he wishes to go. He says, "I am going to prepare myself for a great life work. I have faith in my future. I have made a vow to myself to succeed, and I am going to do so on a broad-gauge plan. I am not going to start out half-equipped, half-fitted. I will have college training." When you find a boy who resolves within himself that, come what will, he is going to do the thing he sets his heart on, and that there are no ifs or buts or ands about it, you may be sure he's made of winning stuff. He will not postpone and postpone the realization of his vision until too late, until his glory has vanished. He will lose no time in putting forth all his energy to make it real, and if it is a possible thing, he will succeed. End of chapter 8. Chapter 9 of He Can Who Thinks He Can by Orison Swett Marden. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Has your vocation your unqualified approval? I quote from the following sentence from a letter just received. In your February editorial, the following paragraph has impressed me mightily. To spend a life in buying and selling lies, or cheap, shoddy shams, is demoralizing to every element of nobility, to excellence in any form. Now, I happen to be in the sham business and hate it so heartily that I want to get out of it as soon as I can do so with justice to others' interests. This young man, who gets more than $10,000 a year in salary, says that he is expected to trade upon the credulity of the poorer classes who can ill afford to be preyed upon. And he continues, "While I need the money, I cannot enjoy this kind of work, nor can I write with conviction or ambition on projects which I naturally know to be fakes. Besides, I am afraid of the very thing pointed out in your editorial, namely growing down to the work. I hate hypocrisy worse than any other thing, and I cannot do my best work in any business based on such a foundation. I do not want to remain in an occupation which pays its highest salaries to the most skillful fakers." It is pitiable to see a strong, brilliant, promising young man, capable of filling a high position, trying to support himself and his family in an occupation which has not received his approval, which is lowering his ideals, which dwarfs his nature, which makes him despise himself, which strangles all that is best and noblest within him, and which is constantly condemning him and ostracizing him and his family from all that is best and truest in life. How often we hear a young man say, "I do not like the business I am in. I know it has a bad influence on me. I do not believe in the methods used or the deceptions practiced. I am ashamed to have my friends know what I am doing, and I say as little about it in public as possible. I know I ought to change, but it is the only business I understand in which I can earn as much money as I need to keep up appearances, for I have been getting a good salary, and I have contracted expensive habits of living, and I have not the force of character to risk a change." Do not deceive yourself with the idea that somebody has got to do this questionable work and that it might as well be you. Let other people do it, if they will. There is something better for you. The Creator has given you a guarantee, written in your blood and brain cells, that if you keep yourself clean and do that which He has indicated in your very constitution, you will be a man, will succeed, and will belong to the order of true nobility. But if you do not heed that edict, you will fail. You may get a large salary, but this alone is not success. If the almighty dollar is dragging its slimy trail all through your career, if money-making has become your one unwavering claim, you have failed, no matter how much you have accumulated. If your money smells of the blood of the innocent, if there is a dirty dollar in it, if there is a taint of avarice in it, if envy and greed have helped in its accumulation, if there is a sacrifice of the rights and comforts of others in it, if there is a stain of dishonor on your stocks and bonds, or if a smirched character looms up in your pile, do not boast of your success, for you have failed. Making money by dirty work is bad business, gild it how we will. There are a thousand indications in you that the Creator did not fit you for what is wrong, but only for the right. Do the right, and all nature, all law, and all science will help you, because the attainment of rectitude is the plan of the universe. It is the very nature of things. Reverse it, and all these forces are pledged to defeat you. To the young men who have written for advice, let me say that if you are making money by forcing yourself by sheer willpower to do what you loathe, what does not engage your whole heart, or that into which you cannot fling your entire being because you fear that it is not quite right, you can do a thousand times better in an occupation which has your unreserved, unqualified consent. If you refuse to smirch your ability, no matter what the reward, you will thereby increase your success power a thousandfold. The very fact that you can come out of a questionable situation boldly and take a stand for the right, regardless of consequences, will help you immeasurably. The greater self-respect, increased self-confidence, and the tonic influence which will come from the sense of victory will give you the air of a conqueror instead of that of one conquered. Nobody ever loses anything by standing for the right with decision, with firmness, and with vigor. You have a compass within you, the needle of which points more surely to the right and to the true than the needle of the mariner points to the pole star. If you do not follow it, you are in perpetual danger of going to pieces on the rocks. Your conscience is your compass, given you when you were launched upon life's high seas. It is the only guide that is sure to take you safely into the harbor of true success. What if a mariner should refuse to steer by the pointing of his compass, declaring it to be all nonsense, that the needle should always point north, and should pull it around so that it would point in some other direction, fasten it there, and then sail by it? He would never reach the port in safety. It takes only a little influence, just a little force, to pull the needle away from its natural pointing. Your conscious compass must not be influenced by greed or expediency. You must not trammel it. You must leave it free. The man who tampers with the needle of his conscience, who pulls it away from its natural love, and who tries to convince himself that there are other standards of right, other stars as reliable as the pole star of his character, and proposes to follow them in some questionable business, is a deluded fool who invites disaster. Every little while I meet young men who dislike to tell me what their vocation is. They seem ashamed of what they're doing. One young man I met some time ago very reluctantly told me that he was a bartender in a large saloon. I asked him how long he had been there, and he said about 6 years. He said he hated the business. It was degrading. But that he was making pretty good money, and just as soon as he could get enough laid up so that he could afford it, he was going to quit and go into something else. Now this young man had been deceiving himself for years by thinking he was doing pretty well, and that he would soon leave the business. There is something very demoralizing to the whole nature in doing that against which the better self protests. An effort to reconcile the ideal with that which we cannot respect is fatal to all growth. This is the reason why men shrivel and shrink instead of expanding when they are out of place. A man does not grow when a large part of him is entering its protest against his work. A volunteer makes a better soldier than a drafted man. A great many young men try to justify themselves and check inward protests by the perpetual self-suggestion that it is better to keep on for the present, in questionable occupations, because the great financial reward will put them in a position to do better later. This is a sort of sedative to the conscious, to keep it quiet until they can afford to listen to it. Do not deceive yourself by the expectation of making clean money in a dirty occupation. Do not deceive yourself either by thinking you can elevate a bad business or make it respectable. Many a man has thus been dragged down to his ruin. Some occupations are so demoralizing, brutalizing, and hardening that even a Lincoln could not make them respectable. If what you are doing is wrong, stop it. You have nothing to do with it. If you are in doubt, or if you suspect that you are warping your conscience, give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Take no chances with it. Leave it before it's too late. Long familiarity with a bad business will make it seem right to you. If it is very profitable, it will at last hush your doubts and blunt your moral faculties. It will make you feel that there is compensation in pursuing it, at least until capital is accumulated for something else. Besides, the philosophy of habit, that is, every repetition of an act makes it more certain that it will be repeated again and again, quickly making the doer a slave. In spite of the protests of your weakened will, the trained nerve centers continue to repeat the acts even when you abhor them. What you at first choose at last compels you. You are as irrevocably chained to your deeds as the atoms are chained by gravitation. So, my friends, when you are thinking of engaging in an occupation which is a little questionable and which does not get the complete consent of your faculties, do not forget this tremendous gripping power of habit, which, when you may wish to change, will pull like a giant to get you back into the old rut. You have no right to choose an occupation which calls into play your inferior qualities, the lying, cunning, overreaching, scheming, long-headed, underhand qualities, those which covet and grasp and snatch and never give, while all that is noblest in you shrivels and dies. If you have already made a wrong choice, why should you remain in an occupation which does not have your unqualified approval, or in one of which you are ashamed, and in which you have to stretch your conscience every day to make deceitful statements and false representations to influence purchasers unduly, to induce them by a smooth manner and a lying tongue to do that which you know is not for their advantage, and for which you will reproach yourself afterwards? Why should you desecrate your manhood and pervert your ability in a contemptible occupation, when there are so many clean, respectable vocations which are searching for your ability and hunting for your talent? You say that it is hard for you to change. Of course it is hard to jog along in humdrum toil for the sake of being honest when acquaintances all around are getting rich by leaps and bounds. Of course it takes courage to refuse to bend the knee to questionable methods, lies, schemes, and fraud when they are so generally used. Of course it takes courage to tell the exact truth when a little deception or a little departure from the right would bring great temporary gain. Of course it takes courage to refuse to be bribed when it could be covered up by a little specious mystification. Of course it takes courage to stand erect when by bowing and scraping to people with a pole you can get inside information which will make you win what you know others must lose. Of course it takes courage to determine never to put into your pocket a dirty dollar, a lying, deceitful dollar, a dollar that drips with human sorrow, or a dollar that has made some poor, gullible wretch poorer, or has defeated another's cherished plans, or robbed him of ambition or education. But this is what character is for. This is what manhood means. This is what backbone and stamina were given us for, to stand for the right and oppose the wrong, no matter what the results. Wear threadbare clothes if necessary. Live on one meal a day in a house with bare floors and bare walls if you must. But under no circumstances ever consent to prostitute your manhood or to turn your ability to do an unclean thing. Dig trenches. Carry hod, work as a section hand on a railroad, shovel coal, anything rather than sacrifice your self-respect, blunt your sense of right and wrong, and shut yourself off forever from the true joy of living and the approbation which comes only from the consciousness of doing your level best to reach the highest that is possible to you. Do not choose that occupation which has the most money in it, the greatest promise of material reward, notoriety or fame even. But choose that which will call out the man in you, and which will develop your greatest strength and symmetry of manhood, personal nobility. Manhood is greater than wealth and grander than fame. Personal nobility is greater than any calling or any reward that it can bring. End of chapter 9. Chapter 10 of He Can Who Thinks He Can by Orison Swett Marden. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Stand for something. The greatest thing that can be said of a man, no matter how much he has achieved, is that he has kept his record clean. Why is it that in spite of the ravages of time, the reputation of Lincoln grows larger and his character means more to the world every year? It is because he kept his record clean and never prostituted his ability nor gambled with his reputation. Where, in all history, is there an example of a man who was merely rich, no matter how great his wealth, who exerted such a power for good, who was such a living force in civilization, as was this poor backwoods boy? What a powerful illustration of the fact that character is the greatest force in the world. A man assumes importance and becomes a power in the world just as soon as it is found that he stands for something, that he is not for sale, that he will not lease his manhood for any salary, for any amount of money, or for any influence or position, that he will not lend his name to anything which he cannot endorse. The trouble with so many men today is that they do not stand for anything outside their vocation. They may be well educated, well up on their specialities, may have a lot of expert knowledge, but they cannot be depended upon. There is some flaw in them which takes the edge off their virtue. They may be fairly honest, but you cannot bank on them. It is not difficult to find a lawyer or a physician who knows a good deal, who is eminent in his profession, but it is not so easy to find one who is a man before he is a lawyer or a physician, whose name is a synonym for all that is clean, reliable, solid, substantial. It is not difficult to find a good preacher, but it is not so easy to find a real man, sterling manhood, back of the sermon. It is easy to find successful merchants, but not so easy to find men who put character above merchandise. What the world wants is men who have principle underlying their expertness, principle under their law, their medicine, their business, men who stand for something outside of their offices and stores, who stand for something in their community, whose very presence carries weight. Everywhere we see smart, clever, long-headed, shrewd men, but how comparatively rare it is to find one whose record is as clean as a hound's tooth, who will not swerve from the right, who would rather fail than be a party to a questionable transaction. Everywhere we see businessmen putting the stumbling blocks of deception and dishonest methods right across their own pathway, tripping themselves up while trying to deceive others. We see men worth millions of dollars filled with terror, trembling lest investigations may uncover things which will damn them in the public estimation. We see them cowed before the law like whipped spaniels, catching at any straw that will save them from public disgrace. What a terrible thing to live in the limelight of popular favor, to be envied as rich and powerful, to be esteemed as honorable and straightforward, and yet to be conscious all the time of not being what the world thinks we are, to live in constant terror of discovery, in fear that something may happen to unmask us and show us up in our true light. But nothing can happen to injure seriously the man who lives foursquare to the world, who has nothing to cover up, nothing to hide from his fellows, who lives in a transparent, clean life, with never a fear of disclosures. If all his material possessions are swept away from him, he knows that he has a moment in the hearts of his countrymen, in the affection and admiration of the people, and that nothing can happen to harm his real self because he has kept his record clean. Mr. Roosevelt early resolved that, let what would come, whether he succeeded in what he undertook or failed, whether he made friends or enemies, he would not take chances with his good name. He would part with everything else first. That he would never gamble with his reputation, that he would keep his record clean. His first ambition was to stand for something, to be a man. Before he was a politician or anything else, the man must come first. In his early career, he had many opportunities to make a great deal of money by allying himself with crooked, sneaking, unscrupulous politicians. He had all sorts of opportunities for political graft, but crookedness never had any attraction for him. He refused to be a party to any political jobbery, any underhand business. He preferred to lose any position he was seeking, to let somebody else have it, if he must get smirched in the getting it. He would not touch a dollar, place, or preferment unless it came to him clean, with no trace of jobbery on it. Politicians who had an axe to grind knew it was no use to try to bribe him or to influence him with promises of patronage, money, position, or power. Mr. Roosevelt knew perfectly well that he would make many mistakes and many enemies, but he resolved to carry himself in such a way that even his enemies should at least respect him for his honesty of purpose and for his straightforward, square-deal methods. He resolved to keep his record clean, his name white, at all hazards. Everything else seemed unimportant in comparison. In times like these, the world especially needs men as Mr. Roosevelt, men who hew close to the chalk line of right and hold the line plumb to truth, men who do not pander to public favor, men who make duty and truth their goal and go straight to their mark, turning neither to the right nor to the left, though a paradise tempt them. Who can ever estimate how much his influence has done toward purging politics and elevating the American ideal? He has changed the viewpoint of many statesmen and politicians. He has shown them a new and better way. He has made many of them ashamed of the old methods of grafting and selfish greed. He has held up a new ideal, shown them that unselfish service to their country is infinitely nobler than an ambition for self-aggrandizement. American patriotism has a higher meaning today because of the example of this great American. Many young politicians and statesmen have adopted cleaner methods and higher aims because of his influence. There is no doubt that tens of thousands of young men in this country are cleaner in their lives and more honest and ambitious to be good citizens, because here is a man who always stands for the square deal, for civic righteousness, for American manhood. Every man ought to feel that there is something in him that bribery cannot touch, that influence cannot buy, something that is not for sale, something he would not sacrifice or tamper with for any price, something he would give his life for if necessary. If a man stands for something worthwhile, compelled recognition for himself alone on account of his real worth, he is not dependent upon recommendations, upon fine clothes, a fine house, or a pole. He is his own best recommendation. The young man who starts out with the resolution to make his character his capital and to pledge his whole manhood for every obligation he enters into will not be a failure, though he wins neither fame nor fortune. No man ever really does a great thing who loses his character in the process. No substitute has ever yet been discovered for honesty. Multitudes of people have gone to the wall trying to find one. Our prisons are full of people who have attempted to substitute something else for it. No man can really believe in himself when he is occupying a false position and wearing a mask. When the little monitor within him is constantly saying, "You know you are a fraud. You are not the man you pretend to be." The consciousness is not being genuine, not being what others think him to be, robs a man of power, honeycombs the character, and destroys self-respect and self-confidence. When Lincoln was asked to take the wrong side of a case, he said, "I could not do it. All the time, while talking to that jury, I should be thinking, 'Lincoln, you're a liar. You're a liar,' and I believe I should forget myself and say it out loud." Character as capital is very much underestimated by a great number of young men. They seem to put more emphasis upon smartness, shrewdness, long-headedness, cunning, influence, a pull, than upon downright honesty and integrity of character. Yet why do scores of concerns pay enormous sums for the use of the name of a man who perhaps has been dead for half a century or more? It is because there is power in that name, because there is character in it, because it stands for something, because it represents reliability and square dealing. Think of what the name of Tiffany, of Park and Tilford, or any of the great names which stand in the commercial world as solid and immovable as the Rock of Gibraltar, are worth. Does it not seem strange that young men who know these facts should try to build up a business on a foundation of cunning, scheming, and trickery, instead of building on the solid rock of character, reliability, and manhood? Is it not remarkable that so many men should work so hard to establish a business on an unreliable, flimsy foundation, instead of building upon the solid masonry of honest goods, square dealing, and reliability? A name is worth everything until it is questioned, but when suspicion clings to it, it is worth nothing. There is nothing in this world that will take the place of character. There is no policy in the world, to say nothing of the right or wrong of it, that compares with honesty and square dealing. In spite of, or because of, all the crookedness and dishonesty that is being uncovered, of all the scoundrels that are being unmasked, integrity is the biggest word in the business world today. There never was a time in all history when it was so big, and it is growing bigger. There never was a time when character meant so much in business, when it stood for so much everywhere as it does today. There was a time when the man who was the shrewdest and sharpest and cunningest in taking advantage of others got the biggest salary, but today the man at the other end of the bargain is looming up as never before. Nathan Strauss, when asked the secret of the great success of his firm, said it was their treatment of the man at the other end of the bargain. He said they could not afford to make enemies, they could not afford to displease or take advantage of customers, or to give them reason to think that they had been unfairly dealt with, that in the long run the man who gave the squarest deal to the man at the other end of the bargain would get ahead fastest. There are merchants who have made great fortunes, but who do not carry weight among their fellow men because they have dealt all their lives with inferiority. They have lived with shoddy and shams so long that the suggestion has been held in their minds until their whole standards of life have been lowered. Their ideals have shrunken. Their characters have partaken of the quality of their business. Contrast these men with the men who stood for half a century or more at the head of solid houses, substantial institutions, men who have always stood for quality in everything, who have surrounded themselves not only with ability, but with men and women of character. We instinctively believe in character. We admire people who stand for something, who are centered in truth and honesty. It is not necessary that they agree with us. We admire them for their strength, the honesty of their opinions, the inflexibility of their principles. The late Carl Schurz was a strong man and agonized many people. He changed his political views very often. But even his worst enemies knew there was one thing he would never go back on, friends or no friends, party or no party. And that was his devotion to principle as he saw it. There was no parleying with his convictions. He could stand alone, if necessary, with all the world against him. His inconsistencies, his many changes in parties and politics, could not destroy the universal admiration for the man who stood for his convictions. Although he escaped from a German prison and fled his country, where he had been arrested on account of his revolutionary principles when but a mere youth, Emperor William I had such a profound respect for his honesty of purpose and his strength of character that he invited him to return to Germany and visit him, gave him a public dinner, and paid him great tribute. Who can estimate the influence of President Eliot in enriching and uplifting our national ideas and standards through the thousands of students who go out from Harvard University? The tremendous force and nobility of character of Phillips Brooks raised everyone who came within his influence to higher levels. His great earnestness in trying to lead people up to his lofty ideal swept everything before it. One could not help feeling while listening to him and watching him that there was a mighty triumph of character, a grand expression of superb manhood. Such men as these increase our faith in the race, in the possibilities of the grandeur of the coming man. We are prouder of our country because of such standards. It is the ideal that determines the direction of life. And what a grand sight, what an inspiration, are those men who sacrifice the dollar to the ideal. The principles by which the problem of success is solved are right and justice, honesty and integrity, and just in proportion as a man deviates from these principles, he falls short of solving his problem. It is true that he may reach something. He may get money, but is that success? The thief gets money, but does he succeed? Is it any honester to steal by means of a long head than by means of a long arm? It is very much more dishonest, because the victim is deceived and then robbed, a double crime. We often receive letters which read like this: I am getting a good salary, but I do not feel right about it somehow. I cannot still the voice within me that says, wrong, wrong, to do what I am doing. Leave it, leave it, we always say to the writers of these letters. Do not stay in a questionable occupation, no matter what inducement it offers. Its false light will land you on the rocks if you follow it. It is demoralizing to the mental faculties, paralyzing to the character, to do a thing which one's conscience forbids. Tell the employer who expects you to do questionable things that you cannot work for him unless you can put the trademark of your manhood, the stamp of your integrity, upon everything you do. Tell him that if the highest thing in you cannot bring success, surely the lowest cannot. You cannot afford to sell the best thing in you, your honor, your manhood, to a dishonest man or a lying institution. You should regard even the suggestion that you might sell out for a consideration as an insult. Resolve that you will not be paid for being something less than a man, that you will not lease your ability, your education, your inventiveness, your self-respect for a salary, to do a man's lying for him, either in writing advertisements, selling goods, or in any other capacity. Resolve that, whatever your vocation, you are going to stand for something, that you are not going to be merely a lawyer, a physician, a merchant, a clerk, a farmer, a congressman, or a man who carries a big money bag, but that you are going to be a man first, last, and all the time. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11 of He Can Who Thinks He Can by Orison Swett Marden. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Happy? If not, why not? We have seen many examples during the past few months of the failure of wealth to produce happiness. We have seen that a fortune without a man behind it does not stand for much. The X-rays of public investigation have revealed some ghastly spectacles. Of a number of rich men who were in positions of great responsibility and trust at the beginning of the recent financial panic, some have committed suicide, others have died from the effects of the disgrace which they had brought upon themselves and their families, and still others have suffered tortures, not so much because of the wrongdoings as from the fear of disclosure. A few months ago, these men were supposed to possess the things which made men happy. They had what all the world is seeking so strenuously. Money. They lived in palatial homes and were surrounded with luxuries, and yet, the moment misfortune came, what they called happiness fled as though it had the wings of a bird. These men felt secure because they had that which most people are struggling so hard to get. They had supposed themselves so firmly entrenched in the wherewithal of life, but so buttressed by their solid investments that nothing could shake them. But almost in the twinkling of an eye, their foundations slipped from under them, their reputations vanished, and instead of being the big men they thought they were, they not only found out that they were nobodies, but also that their happiness had flown with their reputations. Happiness is not such a transient visitor as that. If these men had had the genuine article, no panic could have shaken it, no fire burned it out, no ocean swallowed it up. Real happiness is not a fluttering, fly-away unreality. It is not superficial. It does not live in things. It does not depend upon money. It inheres in character, in personality. It consists in facing life the right way, and no one who faces it the wrong way, no matter how much money he may have, can ever be happy. The trouble with many of the men who went down in the panic was that they put the emphasis upon the wrong thing. Man is built upon the plan of honesty, of rectitude, the divine plan. When he perverts his nature by trying to express dishonesty, chicanery, and cunning, of course he cannot be happy. The very essence of happiness is honesty, sincerity, truthfulness. He who would have real happiness for his companion must be clean, straightforward, and sincere. The moment he departs from the right, she will take wings and fly away. What a pitiable thing it is to see the human race chasing the dollar, material things, trying to extract happiness, to squeeze joy out of money alone. How little people realize that the very thing they are hunting lives in themselves or nowhere, that if they do not take happiness with them, they may hunt the earth over without finding it. Happiness is a condition of mind. It is a fundamental principle, and he who does not understand the principle cannot possibly be happy. All the misery and the crime of the world rest upon this failure of human beings to understand the principle that no man can really be happy until he harmonizes with the best thing in him, with the divine, and not with the brute. No one can be happy who tries to harmonize his life with his animal instincts. The God, the good, in him is the only possible thing that can make him happy. Real happiness cannot be bribed by anything sordid or low. Nothing mean or unworthy appeals to it. There is no affinity between them. Founded upon principle, it is as scientific as the laws of mathematics, and he who works his problem correctly will get the happiness answer. There is only one way to secure the correct answer to a mathematical problem, and that is to work in harmony with mathematical laws. It would not matter if half the world believed there was some other way to get the answer. It would never come until the law was followed with the utmost exactitude. It does not matter that the great majority of the human race believe there is some other way of reaching the happiness goal. The fact that they are discontented, restless, and unhappy shows that they are not working their problem scientifically. We are all conscious that there is another man inside of us, that there accompanies us through life a divine, silent messenger, that other, higher, better self which speaks from the depths of our nature and which gives its consent, its amen, to every right action and condemns every wrong one. Men and women in all times have tried to bribe this constant monitor, to purchase its approval, to silence it in nervous excitement, to drown it in vicious pleasure with drink and with drugs, but all in vain. Men in every age have disregarded its warning, have tried in every possible way to get away from its tormenting reproofs when they have done wrong, but no amount of dissipation or excitement has ever been able to silence its voice. It always continues to give its unbiased, unbribed approval or disapproval to whatever we do. There is nothing in which people deceive themselves so much as in the pursuit of happiness. There is only one way to find it. That is, by obeying the laws upon which we are built. We are constructed along the lines of truth and justice, and we cannot reach felicity by disobeying these, the very laws of our nature. So long as we continue to do evil, to get money by unfair means, by robbing others or taking advantage of them, so long as our ambition is to get rich anyway, we can never attain true happiness, because we are going in the wrong direction. We are introducing discord into our natures, encouraging the very opposite to what we are seeking. It is just as impossible for a person to reach the normal state of harmony while he is practicing selfish, grasping methods, as it is to produce harmony in an orchestra with instruments that are all jangled and out of tune. To be happy, we must be in tune with the infinite in us, in harmony with our better selves. There is no way to get around it. The idea that we can practice wrong in our vocations, in our dealings with men, or in our pleasures, and then periodically seek forgiveness in our prayers or through our churches, the idea that a man can do wrong and be forgiven without remedying the wrong, or without forsaking the sin, has done more harm than almost any other thing in civilization. A clear conscience, a clean life, the elimination of selfishness, jealousy, envy, and hatred are necessary to all high enjoyment. One trouble with many of us is that we try to make happiness too complicated an affair. But happiness really flees from complication, ceremony, and pretense. Nature has fixed her everlasting edict against complicated living. You can never force pleasure. It must be natural. It must come from sane living. Real happiness is so simple that most people do not recognize it. They think it comes from doing something on a big scale, from a big fortune, or from some great achievement, when in fact it is derived from the simplest, the quietest, the most unpretentious things in the world. Our great problem is to fill each day so full of sunshine, of plain living and high thinking, that there can be no commonness or unhappiness in our lives. Little kindnesses, pleasant words, and helps by the way, trifling courtesies and encouragements, duties faithfully done, unselfish service, work that we enjoy, friendships, love, and affection, all these are simple things, yet they are what constitute happiness. The great sanitariums, the noted springs of the world, are crowded with rich people, sent there by their physicians to get rid of the effects of complicated living. They tried to force their pleasures and came to grief. Not long ago, I dined in the home of a very rich man, and it took 2 hours and a half to serve the dinner. There were 13 courses, made up of the richest kinds of food, and many of them absolutely incompatible with one another. In addition to this, there were 7 kinds of wine. Think of anyone being healthy or happy living upon such a diet. What are the enjoyments of the average rich? Is there anything more vapid, insipid, unsatisfying than the chasing after that infinite, mysterious something which they call happiness, that will-o'-the-wisp which is always beckoning them on, but ever eluding their grasp, that rainbow which recedes as they approach? They may enjoy the titillation of the nerves for a moment, the temporary excitement and exhilaration which comes from even vicious pleasures. But what of it all? It is only animal enjoyment. Nothing but regret, disappointment, and disgust follow. There is within every normal person a strong desire to do something and to be something in the world, and every idler knows that he is violating the fundamental demand of his nature, that he is really cheating himself out of a very sacred prize, the getting of which would mean more to him than everything else in the world. I have talked with idle rich young men who said they knew that it was all wrong for them to refuse to do their part of the world's work, that it was a mistake for them not to enter into the activities of life and struggle for a prize which the Creator had fitted them to take, but that the paralyzing effect of not being obliged to work had undermined their inclination. Recently, a rich young man was asked why he did not work. "I do not have to," he said. "Do not have to" has ruined more young men than almost anything else. The fact is, nature never made any provision for the idle man. Vigorous activity is the law of life. It is the saving grace, the only thing that can keep a human being from retrograding. Activity along the line of one's highest ambition is the normal state of man, and he who tries to evade it pays the penalty in deterioration of faculty, in paralysis of efficiency. Do not flatter yourself that you can be really happy unless you are useful. Happiness and usefulness were born twins. To separate them is fatal. It is impossible for a human being to be happy who is habitually idle, as it is for a fine chronometer to be normal when not running. The highest happiness is the feeling of well-being which comes from one who is actively employed in doing what he was made to do, carrying out the great life purpose patterned in his individual bent. The practical fulfilling of the life purpose is to man what the actual running and keeping of time are to the watch. Without action, both are meaningless. There is no tonic like that which comes from doing things worthwhile. There is no happiness like that which comes from doing our level best every day, everywhere. No satisfaction like that which comes from stamping our superiority, putting our royal trademark upon everything which goes through our hands. Man was made to do things. Nothing else can take the place of achievement in his life. Real happiness without achievement of some worthy aim is unthinkable. One of the greatest satisfactions in this world is the feeling of enlargement, of growth, of stretching upward and onward. No pleasure can surpass that which comes from the consciousness of feeling one's horizons of ignorance being pushed farther and farther away, of making headway in the world, of not only getting on, but also of getting up. Happiness is incompatible with stagnation. A man must feel his expanding power lifting, tugging away at a lofty purpose, or he will miss the joy of living. The discords, the bickerings, and divorces, the breaking up of rich homes and the resorting to all sorts of silly devices by many rich people in their pursuit of happiness, prove that it does not dwell within them, that happiness does not abide with low ideals, with selfishness, idleness, and discord. It is a friend of harmony, of truth and beauty, of affection and simplicity. Multitudes of men have made fortunes, but have murdered their capacity for enjoyment in the process. How often we hear the remark, "He has the money, but cannot enjoy it." A man can have no greater delusion than that he can spend the best years of his life coining all of his energies into dollars, neglecting his home, sacrificing friendships, self-improvement, and everything else that is really worthwhile, for money, and yet find happiness at the end. If a man coins his ability, his opportunities into dollars, and during all the years he is accumulating wealth, neglects the cultivation of the only faculties which are capable of appreciating the highest happiness, he cannot effectively revive his atrophied brain cells. His enjoyment, after he makes his money, must come from the exercise of the same faculties which he has employed in making it. He cannot undo the results of a life habit after he retires from business. If you have not kept alive your ability to appreciate the beautiful, the good, and the true, you will be as surprised to find that it has left you as Darwin was when, in the middle of life, he discovered that all at once that he had lost his power to appreciate Shakespeare and music. We ought to be able to get a good living, even to make fortunes, and yet have a jolly good time every day of our lives. This idea of being a slave most of the time, and of only occasionally enjoying a holiday, is all wrong. Every day should be a holiday, a day of joy and gladness, a day of supreme happiness, and it would be if we lived sanely, if we knew the secret of right thinking and normal living. Isn't it strange that so few people ever think of making happiness a daily duty, that they should put this everlasting emphasis upon their vocations, on money-making, and let the thing for which they really live come incidentally or without planning? The making of a life should be emphasized infinitely more than the making of a living. Few people ever learn the art of enjoying the little things of life as they go along. Yet it is the little, everyday enjoyments and satisfactions that count most in a lifetime. Almost every person I know is living in anticipation, not in reality. He's not actually living the life he has always looked forward to or expected to attain, but is just getting ready to live, just getting ready to enjoy it. When he gets a little more money, a little better house, a little more of the comforts of life, a little more leisure, a little more freedom from responsibility, he will then be ready to enjoy life. It is a rare thing to find a person who can truthfully say, "I'm really living. This is the life I've been striving for, the life that I have looked forward to as being as near my ideal as I'm likely to find in this world." It is a great thing so to cultivate the art of happiness that we can get pleasure out of the common experiences of every day. The happiness habit is just as necessary to our best welfare as the work habit, or the honesty, or square-dealing habit. No one can do his best, his highest work, who is not perfectly normal, and happiness is a fundamental necessity of our being. It is an indication of health, of sanity, of harmony. The opposite is a symptom of disease, of abnormality. There are plenty of evidences in the human economy that were intended for happiness, that it is our normal condition, that suffering, unhappiness, discontent are absolutely foreign and abnormal to our natures. There is no doubt that our life was intended to be one grand, sweet song. We are built upon the plan of harmony, and every form of discord is abnormal. There is something wrong when any human being in this world, tuned to infinite harmonies and beauties that are unspeakable, is unhappy and discontented. One of the most inexplicable mysteries that has ever puzzled the selfish rich is their failure to find happiness where they had expected to find it. The bitterest disappointment that comes to people who have made fortunes is that the wealth did not bring the happiness which it promised, or anything like it. They find that the affections do not feed on material things, that the heart would starve in the midst of the greatest luxuries alone. They find that while money can do many things, it has little power to satisfy the heart yearnings, the heart hunger. How many women are there in palatial homes in this country who are starving for happiness and who would gladly exchange all their luxuries for the love of a good man, even if he had not a dollar in the world? No selfish life can ever be happy. I am acquainted with a self-made man who has made a fortune, who tells me that the greatest enigma and disappointment of his life lie in the fact that although he has made millions, he is not happy. He says that somehow he has never been able to make many friends, that people avoid him, that he has never been able to get the confidence of others to any very great extent, and that he is not popular even among his own neighbors. He cannot understand why he is not happy, for he tells me he has tried very hard to find happiness. The trouble with him is that he has always done everything with reference to himself. He did not mean to be selfish, but the whole passion of his life has been to make money, because he thought it would bring everything else that is desirable. He has chosen his friends for their ability to advance his interests, and has considered every step in life with reference to the effect it would have upon him. What is there in it for me? Seems to have been the interrogation point in his life. Now, happiness is a reflection, an echo, a part of what we do and think. It does not depend upon our material possessions. Thoreau's cabin at Walden Pond cost only $31, and yet Thoreau was rich and happy because he had a rich mind. It is impossible for the selfish, greedy, grasping thought, the thought always centered upon one's own interest, to produce a happy state of mind as it is for thistle seeds to produce wheat. But if we sow helpfulness, kindness, unselfishness, we shall reap a harvest of satisfaction, harmony, and happiness. Selfishness and real happiness never go together. They are fatally antagonistic. An inordinate ambition, a desire to get ahead of others, a mania to keep up appearances at all hazards, whether we can afford it or not, all these things feed selfishness, that corrosive acid which eats away our possible enjoyment and destroys the very sources of happiness. The devouring ambition to get ahead of others in money-making, to outshine others socially, develops a sordid, grasping disposition which is the bane of happiness. No man with greed developed big within him can be happy. Neither contentment, satisfaction, serenity, affection, nor any other member of the happiness family can exist in the presence of greed. It is as impossible for a man who has been dishonest, who has gotten his wealth by crushing others, and by taking advantage of them, to be happy as it is for a person really to enjoy himself while walking with pebbles in his shoes, or while constantly being nettled with pinpricks. No man can be happy who is conscious of being a drone, of shirking his share in the great world's work, who knows that he is taking all the good things he can get a hold of in life's great granary, put there by the toilers, and is putting nothing back. A debauched mind that has departed from the principles of right thinking and right living has incapacitated itself for real enjoyment. The only way to get the happiness that is worthwhile is to live a straight, clean, pure, honest, useful life. There is no power in the universe that can make a human being happy along any other lines. Straightforward, honest work, a determined endeavor to do one's best, an earnest desire to scatter flowers instead of thorns, to make other people a little better off, a little happier because of our existence. These are the only recipes for real happiness. No man can be happy when he despises his own acts, when he has any consciousness of wrong, whether of motive or act. No man can be happy when he harbors thoughts of revenge, jealousy, envy, or hatred. He must have a clean heart and a clean conscience, or no amount of money or excitement can make him happy. End of chapter 11. Chapter 12 of He Can Who Thinks He Can by Orison Swett Marden. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Originality. No human being ever yet made a success trying to be somebody else, even if that person was a success. Success cannot be copied, cannot be successfully imitated. It is an original force, an individual creation. Every man will be a failure just in proportion as he gets away from himself and tries to be somebody else, and to express somebody else instead of himself. Power comes from within or from nowhere. Be yourself. Listen to the voice within. There is room for improvement in every profession, in every trade, and in every business. The world wants men who can do things in new and better ways. Don't think because your plan or idea has no precedent, or because you are young and inexperienced, that you will not get a hearing. The man who has anything new and valuable to give to the world will be listened to and will be followed. The man of strong individuality, who dares to think his own thought and originate his own method, who is not afraid to be himself and is not a copy of someone else, quickly gets recognition. Nothing else will attract the attention of an employer or the rest of the world so quickly as originality and unique ways of doing things, especially if they are effective. Blaze your own way, make your own path, or you will never make any impression on the world. It is striking originality that attracts attention. The world admires the man who has the courage to lift his head above the crowd, who dares to step to the front and declare himself. Never before was originality so much at a premium. The world makes way for the man with an idea. It is the thinker, the man with original ideas and the new up-to-date methods, who is the real productive force in a community. He is wanted everywhere. But there is very little demand for human machines. The world is full of followers, learners, and taggers, who are willing to walk in old trails, and to have their thinking done for them. But it is seeking the man with original force who leaves the unbeaten track and pushes into new fields, the physician who departs from the precedent of those who have gone before him, the lawyer who conducts his case in an original way, the teacher who brings new ideas and methods into the schoolroom, and the clergyman who has the courage to proclaim the message which God has given to him, not that given to some other man who has put it into a book. The world wants preachers who get their sermons out of life, not out of a library. There are 1,000 people who will do faithfully what they are told, to one who can lay out a program or execute it. 1,000 who can only follow, to one who can lead. It is a rare thing to find a young man who has the power of initiative and the ability to put a thing through with the force of originality. Whatever your work in life, do not follow others. Do not imitate. Do not do things just as everybody else has done them before, but in new, ingenious ways. Show the people in your specialty that precedents do not cut much of a figure with you, and that you will make your own program. Resolve that, whether you accomplish much or little in the world, it shall be original, your own. Do not be afraid to assert yourself in a bold individual way. Originality is power, life. Imitation is death. Do not be afraid to let yourself out. You grow by being original, never by copying, by leading, never by following. Resolve that you will be a man of ideas, always on the lookout for improvement. Think to some purpose. There is always a place for an original man. There is nothing else which will kill the creative faculty and paralyze growth more quickly than following precedents in everything and doing everything in the same old way. I have known progressive young men to stop growing, become hopelessly rutty, and lose all their progressiveness by going into their father's stores, factories, or places of business, where everything was done in the same old-fashioned way, and the precedents were followed in everything. They lost all expansiveness. There was no motive for reaching out for the new and the original, because their fathers would not change. I have seen splendid fellows who might have become great and grand men shrivel to pygmies in their fathers' ruts. How many of our business houses are weighted down with machinery, old, antiquated methods, ponderous bookkeeping, and out-of-date appliances, when new devices or new methods with shortcut ways of doing things would enable them to economize greatly on room and to get along with much less help, but they cling to the old with a fatal tenacity. This is why so many old concerns, which have been strong and powerful for generations, gradually shrink, shrivel, get into ruts and fail, while their newer competitors, the bright young men who have gone out from these houses, do things in a new way, adopt up-to-date methods, keep up with the times, and go on to greater success. There is a great advertising quality in originality or uniqueness. The man who does business like the great majority of men, although he may have superior ability, does not attract much attention. But if he makes his own path, adopts original and progressive methods, puts his specialty in a class by itself, and attracts attention, everybody who patronizes him is a traveling advertisement for him. There is a specialty store in Boston whose progressive proprietors make a study of original ways of doing everything. For example, all change is given in brand new money, direct from the United States Treasury or Mint. This does not cost much and causes but little trouble, yet it is a very shrewd advertisement. It is especially attractive to women and children and has brought a great deal of trade. Aside from the danger of handling old soiled money, which has been no one knows where, it gives a sense of pleasure to handle new, crisp bills and brand new bright coins. This is only one of the many unique methods this concern adopts. People flock to the most up-to-date establishments, for they know that the newest styles, the latest and freshest goods, the greatest variety, the best display of taste, and the most appropriate things are to be found there. It is well known that those up-to-date houses pay the largest salaries and have the best buyers. There is a hotel in New York which needs no advertising. It is one of the institutions which people visit out of interest, and they are always talking about it. Other things being equal, they will patronize it. If they cannot afford to have rooms there, they will go there to dine, to see the fashions and prominent people. The amount of free advertising which this hotel has had, in addition to what, perhaps, other first-class hotels get, would probably have cost, if paid for, half as much as the hotel is worth. The same is true in every line of endeavor. It is the newest and the most up-to-date concern that has the latest devices and the freshest and most original ideas that draws the people. Do not, however, make the mistake of thinking that if you simply do things in new ways, you will necessarily be successful. It is effective originality that counts. There are thousands of men who are always chasing new ideas, new ways of doing things, who never accomplish anything of note, because they are not effective, not practical. I know a man who adopts every new device that comes along, and has thus practically run through a large estate left him, because he did not have the judgment or the sagacity to select really effective devices or methods in the management of his affairs. The shrewdest thing a young man can do, to say nothing of the influence upon his character, is to put the greatest possible originality and the highest possible excellence into everything he does, to make a resolution at the very outset of his career to stamp his individuality upon everything that goes out of his hands, and to determine that everything he does shall have the imprint of his character upon it as a trademark of the highest and best that is in him. If he does this, he will not require a large amount of capital to start a business and to advertise it. His greatest resources will be in himself. Originality is the best substitute for advertising, as well as the best thing to advertise, if quality goes with it. Some men are absolutely afraid to do things in a new way. They must follow somebody else. "What was good enough for my father and grandfather is good enough for me," seems to be their motto. They cannot see any reason for changing. They must have a precedent for everything or they reject it. They cannot appreciate a new idea or a new way of doing things. They think there must be something the matter with it if it has not been used before. They have a peculiar love for the old. The antique appeals to them. They think the value of things lies in their age. These people with hidebound intellects stand in the way of progress. Every town has these precedent men in the same old-sized stores with the same old out-of-date shop windows, the same methods of displaying goods, the same old cumbersome systems in the counting room. They are progress-proof. New ideas frighten them. The precedent man is always nonplussed, embarrassed by anything new, or when confronted with a condition which requires something original. He must get hold of something which has been used before, or he is powerless. Many people think it is unfortunate to be unlike others in their personalities. They are always afraid of being thought peculiar or eccentric. Yet the Creator never made two things alike, nor any two people alike. Nature breaks her mold at every new birth. Great characters always have strong individuality and originality, characteristics which mark them from the crowd. To be eccentric is not to be weak, but more often it is a sign of strength. Lincoln had eccentricities, but they were inseparable from his great character. Eccentricities do not make a person disagreeable or repulsive, are often advantages rather than disadvantages. What is more monotonous than a dead level, insipid character that has no strongly marked features which individualize it? We all love a great nature, a strong, vigorous, rugged personality which impresses us with power, something colossal which looms above us and inspires us with awe and admiration, such as we feel when standing under some mighty mountain cliff towering above us into the clouds. We do not wish the rugged crags smoothed off. They add to the peak's sublimity. They suggest majesty and power. Why should we want to plane off the eccentricities of a great character, or the individuality which characterizes him and distinguishes him from all others? We believe in the original man or woman who does not remind us of others, who makes a new, strong, vigorous, and lasting impression upon us, who does not imitate or follow, who makes his own program, who acts upon his own judgment, who leans upon nobody, and who does not ask advice, but acts fearlessly, boldly, independently. We know there is force there that can do things, that can achieve, a reserve power that makes its possessor a master. Fearlessness is a quality absolutely necessary to great achievement. Courage always accompanies force. It is a marked quality of the original man. Imitators are timid, weak. Do not be afraid of being original. Be an independent, self-reliant, new man, not just one more individual in the world. Do not try to be a copy of your grandfather, your father, or your neighbor. That is as foolish as for a violet to try to be like a rose, or for a daisy to ape a sunflower. Nature has given each a peculiar equipment for its purpose. Every man is born to do a certain work in an original way. If he tries to copy some other man, or do some other man's work, he will be an abortion, a misfit, a failure. Do not imitate even your heroes. Scores of young clergymen attempted to make their reputations by imitating Beecher. They copied his voice and conversation, and imitated his gestures and his habits, but they fell as far short of the great man's power as the chromo falls short of the masterpiece. Where are those hundreds of imitators now? Not one of them has ever made any stir in the world. The world puts its ban upon all imitations. It despises a man who tags on to somebody else, leans, or imitates. He is always classed as a weakling, without force, power, or individuality. We hear a great deal about the dangers of the one-man power in our great corporations. People say that they should be managed by large committees or boards of directors, that too much power should not be put into the hands of one man. But there is one original, dominating character in every committee, on every board of directors, who towers above all others and ultimately rules. It is impossible to get away from the domination of a strong, original, forceful character. Just be yourself. The consciousness that you are not another in the slightest degree, that there is no suggestion of being a copy of somebody else about you, is a great power in itself. It increases your confidence. The very reputation of being original buttresses you in any community. It helps you to have people say, after talking with you, "There I met an original man today who did not even remind me of anybody else I have ever seen." It is refreshing to talk with a man who never reminds you of others, who uses no cant, who is not the slave of precedent, who walks on his own legs, who has no use for crutches, and who never leans, a man of force who radiates power. Why try to be somebody else? To be yourself, or to express yourself with originality and power, is the greatest thing you can do. You cannot be another if you try. It only makes you unnatural and ridiculous, and robs you of the power which comes from self-expression, from being yourself. The more you differ from another man by nature, the more ridiculous you will make yourself by attempting to imitate him. Real strength inheres in personality. End of chapter 12.